Welcome. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Here on The Deep State, we go deep into stories that the mainstream media doesn't want you to know. The Deep State imprisoned me once upon a time. Well, now we're going after The Deep State. I want to bring on now Tim Gordon. Tim is a popular Catholic YouTuber, and he hosts the show Rules for Retrogrades. He's also the author of a whole bunch of books. I want to start off with kind of the basics. You have become the go-to guy, really, on YouTube when it comes to current Catholic theology. You're really something of a theologian. What was it that first drew you to Catholic philosophy, and how did that lead you in the direction of deeper Catholic thought?
Like so many young men growing up in the 80s, 90s, and early aughts, I fell away from Christianity, from my Catholic faith, almost as soon as I'd gotten it, because it, unfortunately, that seems like it was in the water, it was in the post-conciliar church, and in the plans to do. The return, thanks be to God, had something to do with the fact that I was always interested in the truth, and the proper study of philosophy, which is what I ended up majoring in as an undergraduate, and then going to Rome to study eventually, and as a graduate student, and taking a law degree eventually. What I really always cared about was truth, qua truth, meaning when you study nature properly and you have the proper philosophy of nature, then you're seeking after truth such as it is. When there are other philosophies such as, you know, errant ones like nominalism or feminism, there is something being surrogated for as the proper object of one's studies, whether it's, you know, seeking some extrinsic good, some extrinsic substitute for nature, like women's power, or to eliminate all essences, to talk as if there's not real truth in the world. This is the number one mark of bad philosophy. It has an ulterior motive. But when you're studying true philosophy, or what, you know, my Catholic tradition calls the perennial philosophy, you are doing a philosophy of nature. You're studying nature qua nature. And ultimately, this led me back to my faith, because God is the author of nature. And when you're studying the perennial philosophy, the creator is being itself. And so when you're studying creation, that means anything created by God, the creatures, you come immediately to the distinction between necessary being, which is God, and all of the things he created, the contingent beings. So when we're studying, whether we're doing a priori philosophy or a posteriori philosophy, philosophy of science or something like that, we creatures are dealing in space and time. God's removed from space and time. But we creatures here below have to deal with being first. Then we can get to the author of being, or pure being, which is God. So philosophy always before theology. And when you do this the right way, when you follow the proper method of investigation, which just means start with the things around you, study them for what they actually are, study truth for what it actually seems to be, you're making a proper study of nature, and eventually this will include God as the author of nature.
Tim, many of my friends who are, whom I would describe as Catholic thinkers, tell me that the basis of their own personal theologies and philosophies rests with St. Augustine and his writings. Which thinkers have most shared your understanding of truth and authority and of culture?
Aristotle, we sometimes call him the blessed pagan. In certain medieval depictions, he was given the green halo because he is a pagan, but he was so important for the Catholic philosophy of nature, understanding of phusis, the world around us, which leads to metaphysics and eventually to theology, that he's called the blessed pagan. And the works of Aristotle, I'll note, the master of those who know, as Dante Alighieri referred to him, were actually mostly unavailable during Augustine's time and the early patristics in both the East and the West. Only a few of his texts were available. They'd slipped into obscurity and actually were taken by the Muslims, only to be discovered in places like Segovia and the Spanish excavations around 1000 AD, a little before 1000 AD. And the most exciting time, in my view, in church history, is when at the University of Paris, now called the Sorbonne, the masters of theology and the masters of the arts were debating, rigorous debates, whether or not Aristotle could or should be incorporated, as his texts were being found in Moorish Spain, into Catholic life or into Catholic perennial philosophy and eventually theology. And the most amazing thing is that the Dominicans there, St. Albert the Great, and most importantly to me, St. Thomas, just said, res ipsa loquitur, this thing suggests itself. This is the philosopher, Aristotle is. And whether we would have it or not, he has aptly described nature 95% correctly. And there is no other pagan philosopher, not Plato, not Socrates, not any of the pre-Socratics, who so accurately described the doctrine of being that we see in nature. So St. Thomas is the one who really, you know, baptizes Aristotle and deeply informed my own thinking. But you know, I call myself an Aristotomist because the doctrine of being there in Aristotle, together with the doctrine of essence in St. Thomas Aquinas, really tells us virtually everything we need to know, meaning it's basically frozen before the year 1300. So those are the two preeminent thinkers, not only in my mind, but in, I would say, virtually every serious Catholic's mind is Aristotle, the philosopher, and St. Thomas. There are other thinkers like Suarez, Bellarmine, even the Muslim Aristotelian commentator, Averroes, who St. Thomas calls the commentator. But these two give us the doctrine of being and the doctrine of nature that I adverted to before. To put it simply, we get a correct philosophy of nature, we Catholics believe, because of these two thinkers, this pagan and this Dominican, Aristotle and St. Thomas.
I want to turn, if we could, to one of your books, Catholic Republic. What did you hope to accomplish with Catholic Republic? And more importantly, perhaps, who were you hoping to reach with this book?
What I was hoping to do with Catholic Republic, which is my first book, was to externalize the internal. I describe America, controversially, I guess, as a Catholic, as a country that's wired Catholic but labeled Protestant and peopled by Protestants originally, but currently functioning secular. Wired Catholic, labeled Protestant, and currently functioning secular. And the basic premise is that although early America was accurately described as demographically Protestant and less accurately described as philosophically Enlightenment, remember the Reformation are basically the intellectual grandparents of what we call the religious right in America. The Enlightenment is essentially the intellectual grandparentage of what today we call the secular left. But it turns out both of these parties had a very, very tortured relationship with the natural law, which is so important not only for the Declaration of Independence, but the Constitution and the things that the founders said that the people needed to have in spades popularly, like virtue ethics and the proper understanding of church-state relations, proper family oikonomia. These only come from the natural law, and they simply can't be found in the religious rights, intellectual grandparentage, the Protestant Reformation. It was a vast, sweeping intra-Christendom rejection of the natural law, and nor can it be found in the secular left's intellectual grandparentage, the Enlightenment, which is a secular rejection of the natural law. We'll talk about this when we discuss maybe what the university is and why it's such a perversion of its initial mission. But the modern world is actually knitted as a first principle to rejecting the natural law. So America, insofar as it represents and depends on and draws from the natural law for things, the goodies that are the first principles to Americans, like natural rights, subsidiarity or local authority, virtue, ethics in the people, mm-hmm. church-state relations, proper church-state relations, family economy, science and technology. You need the proper philosophy of nature for these six things, and you simply can't get it from either of the two supposed fonts of America's intellectual heritage. I call it Prodenlight, the right side, the 16th century Protestant Reformation, or the left side, 17th century Enlightenment. They both reject the natural law. And so when you look at the actual fountain of the river, it is and must be from apostolic Christianity, especially from Roman Catholicism.
Tim, I have to ask you too, as an Orthodox Christian, one of the things that has long fascinated me, and I try to follow all the news that comes out, I'm on all the church news websites, it's the possibility of reunification of the Western Church and the Eastern Church. The split, of course, is more than a millennium ago. It was over the filioque, the reverence of Mary, a couple of other minor issues. And the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church have been meeting regularly since 1965 to try to patch these things together and to bring each other back into communion. Do you see that happening in our lifetimes?
Sincerely, I wish it would.
Yeah,
and
I do too.
Pope Francis, at the end of his tenure as 266th pontiff, was committed to it. Unfortunately, between the leader and leaders of the Orthodox Church and Francis, they're all kind of men of the left, and they were hoping to unite under, I think, an errant philosophical banner. What I hope for, and I think what you hope for, is a true peace, a lasting peace.
Yeah.
You've had my Orthodox friend Jay Dyer on the show, who's catching some heat today for saying proper things, a similar critique to what I've said about Protestant nominalism and their ability to look at nature as such. He's catching a lot of flack for what he said on Tucker. And I would simply add that, there's a few different ways of saying it, but suffice to say here, and I don't want to get into the details, but there is a real means by which the churches could be united. And, we had a Union of Florence in the 1400s the Orthodox Christians did rejoin Roman Catholics. And that's a joyous thing. It's a much more realistic goal than the kind of nominalist, voluntarist, maybe good-spirited Protestants who really have rejected apostolic, sacralized, Episcopal Christianity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a bigger leap to hope that they'll rejoin the fold. Of course, our Pope Benedict has reiterated time and time again, we can refer to the Eastern Orthodox Church as a capital C church or churches. We can't call the Protestant congregations more than that because they don't have the apostolic heritage or lineage. They don't have the sacraments. They don't have priests and bishops. And they don't have any kind of magisterial claim to any of such authority. So there's a real hope for your hope. There's a real footing that could be gotten. And I would say one final thing, that the filioque is, from a Catholic perspective, we still insist on our own view, but we don't think its gravity is quite as momentous as the Orthodox do. So that's something I think we could agree about. And of course, seeing as you guys accepted the Pope for the first 1,000 years, I feel like it's a realistic goal, and it's been done once before.
Yeah, I have to agree. And, just in the last couple of weeks, Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople dropped a bombshell on international orthodoxy by saying, when it comes right down to it, if you look at the actual early history and what the early church fathers said about the date of the Pascha, of Easter, the Catholics are right and we're wrong, and maybe we should just adopt the Western date for Easter. That was an atomic bomb in Orthodoxy, but he was right that the early Orthodox fathers misinterpreted the formula for the date of Easter on the Eastern side. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard. It's exciting in a lot of ways. And like yeah. I said, there are. It's difficult with Protestants because I live in the South. I live in Mississippi. So many good folks out here, but there's so much evangelicalism with all of its just corruptions upon corruptions of true Christian thought. No apostolic Christianity. None yeah. of the marks that described it at Nicaea, marks of true church. Yeah. The dispensationalism out the wazoo. They don't know what priests or bishops are. So, well, where do you begin to unite with Protestants? But with Catholics and Orthodox, I feel a lot of hope. Like I said, I don't think the filioque. I think we actually. I'm a philosopher. So I'm trained right. to say, well, not everything is just a question of semantics. There are real propositional conceptual differences being represented, usually when two people think they're disagreeing. When it comes to the filioque, my actual view is that the Augustinian view of the Trinity and the Cappadocian view is far closer than I think a lot of Orthodox think it is. So I think we're almost speaking the same thing with regard wow. to that. And I know there are other issues. Right. Yeah, I hope that's right. It feels like it would be the ultimate team up if it could be pulled off.
You know, my favorite TV show of all time is The Sopranos. And this is going to sound a little bit incongruous, but there's one scene where Philly Leotardo is talking to I forget who he's talking to. Anyway, they were arguing and they got distracted for a second, and finally Philly says, "What were we arguing about?" And the response is, "I can't remember." Well, this seems to be the nature of this argument. And it's not just between the Catholics and the Orthodox. Within the Orthodox Church, the Mother Church in Constantinople is not in communion with, for example, the Coptic Church or the Ethiopian Church or the Eastern Malayalam Orthodox in southern India. And when you ask even archimandrites or bishops, what's the nature of the disunion between the various Orthodox churches? We can't remember anymore. So it gives me hope that our differences really aren't as bad as we have thought that they are, and that there is going to be communion between the two churches.
I wasn't going to go this far until you said that, but another area that a papal minimalist like myself tends to emphasize when getting into the nitty-gritty here is that at Vatican I, there's something called the Bishop Gasser intervention, which really gives papal minimalists the basis for believing that papal minimalism is what was intended by the church all along. A little bit more than a mere honorary position traditionally described by you Orthodox Christians, but significantly less than the ultramontane maximalist view that too many Catholics hold today. And I tend to think strongly, and I'm not just being diplomatic here, that it's a view, Bishop Gasser's view at Vatican I, Pio Nono made every single father there read before they signed Pastor Eternus, is actually something that would be significantly more amenable to Orthodox because it is minimalist, and it is the way that the Pope actually was in the first millennium and the second millennium. And it also could help with that division upon division. You see it, just the radioactive half-life of division in the Protestant world, right? I mean, there's a new division each day, several a day. You don't have that as much in the Orthodox world, but the very inability to conflate into itself even the Eastern churches that you're referring to, three or four groups there, there needs to be not a maximalist pope, but I would argue a visible sign of unity, which is always what the pope was, a little more than honorary, but less than what the ultramontanists held. So I think there's a lot of legitimate ground for dialogue there. If we could only get
that's actually,
good right-wingers in the church.
That's right. And that's actually the Orthodox perspective is... Yeah. They have no problem with the Pope being the first among equals, but that's the key, the first among equals. Yeah. I want to ask you, too, you're sitting in front of your logo, Rules for Retrograde, and I wanted to talk about the word retrograde. How do you define retrograde, and why reclaim the word? What was the goal there?
Well, I guess partly to be provocative. You see the skull in a shroud. That comes from the... Capuchin Crypt in Rome, right outside of Barberini Piazza.
I've been, yes.
Have you? It's pretty cool. The little words in Latin say, you know, what we are now, you soon will be. What you are now, we once were. It's foreboding, but it's kind of the ultimate memento mori, isn't it? And that's what I'm saying is there's a lot of, in the Catholic world, I'll initiate a bit of self-criticism. We have the, you know, the pre-conciliarists, I'm talking about Vatican II now, not Vatican I, versus the post-conciliarists, the ones that want to go back and reclaim tradition. I go to a Latin mass, for instance, versus the ones who don't. And I have, I guess, I'm not much of a moderate, but in this way, I have a moderate view. My view is retrograde. It's not that LARP traditionalism, you know, live action role playing or cosplaying, mm-hmm. where you pretend you're living in a medieval hilltop village and, you know, pretend you churn your own butter. You know, I have a Switch 2, I have TVs, I enjoy the modern technologies of life, and so do my 8 children. But going back to tradition in the ways over which we can, over the institutions that we actually control. The main institution I control as priest, prophet, king is my own household. I don't pretend that I can tell the Pope, or the last 7 popes for that matter, the Latin Mass is better than the Novus Ordo Mass, you know, after Vatican II. We really need to go back to it. I strongly think that. I'm firmly convinced of it. But it's not my role to do so. So a retrograde is someone that's not a LARP, that takes seriously our Lord's admonition of living in the world but not of the world, meaning reclaim the traditions that have been given away over the last century or century and a half of our institutions we control. I mean, men need to reclaim control over their families. And this is not a hostile takeover. This is one of love, of the priest, the prophet, and the king, like our Lord did. But we can't do so over all institutions, nor do we need to churn butter or, you know, repudiate, spurn technology or electricity or something like that. So it's a kind of traditionalism that I have tried to insulate against being LARPy or pretend cosplaying.
Well, let's talk about that traditionalism, especially here in the United States. We're seeing, not just among Catholics, but among some Protestants, an attempt to return to traditionalism. We're hearing terms like trad wives, traditional wives, and, you know, these alpha males admonishing men to embrace the masculine, to take control of their families and their families' destinies. That is also criticized as patriarchy. So what does patriarchy mean in your work, and why do you think the term is so controversial? Or maybe should it even be controversial?
Oh, of course not. Patriarchy means power to fathers, and it dovetails beautifully with the concept I was discussing earlier of subsidiarity, which is to say, local power is the natural law, you know? I mean, the ref, you know, if you're watching basketball, the ref who judges whether or not, I don't know, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander's foot stepped on the line is the one that was in the position to make the call. So governance being, I hate to use a German term, but it's Dasein, being there. Governance is, it's not that it should be there locally. It's that, ontologically speaking, governance has to be there. If you want to go take your wife out to dinner, you have to get a babysitter to stay there with your kids. You can't just phone in if you have small children, right? Governance is inherently, as a part of the natural law, something that has to be done at the city or at farthest at the state level. It can't be done from Honolulu to Washington, D.C. Well, the first principle of that subsidiarity, that Catholic principle described by Pope Pius XI in Quadragesimo Anno, is patriarchy, that a man is really priest, prophet, king of his home. When you're boss, everything's your fault. But also, you get the authority. You don't just get the blame. And this is patriarchy now, is another name for Christianity. A bimodal patriarchy is what Christianity is. And Orthodox Christian like yourself has no issue with this. It's a bimodal patriarchy, and it always was. Here's what I mean by bimodal. Patriarchy means Christianity. Two levels. The higher level is the clerical patriarchy.
Yes.
Based in our bishops, your bishop, you guys have real bishops. It's tough when you're talking to an Anglican and they think they have bishops, but they're not apostolic. You guys have real bishops, we have real bishops. And they, of course, ordain priests and deacons. That's a patriarchy. There's no women, and they are our spiritual fathers, the higher vocational calling. Well, patriarchy has a lower rung, which is the 99% or what have you. It is the men who are called to populate the butts in the seats of the pews, which is yourself and myself and all the laymen out there. We are called to the vocation, if we're not called to the higher vocation, of being a lay patriarch, which is, J. Dyer actually mentioned this to Tucker the other day, that Chrysostom says there's something like a household church, which is his name for the family. Even Pope John Paul II called the household the ecclesiola, the little church. And men are called to be the priest, prophet, kings, and they're called to have one mission, which is get themselves, their wives and kids, to heaven. And, of course, their spiritual father helps them do so in a kind of internal forum between the priest and bishop. But women are really called not to have their own mission, but as the helpmeet made from the rib of man, to help the man in whatever he sees fit. And it's supposed to be a friendship, but it's not a friendship of equals. Aristotle, in Book 2 of the Politics and in Book, I think, 7 of the Nicomachean Ethics, describes best friendships are best friendships not of peers. You can have close friends who are peers, but the best friendships are those between a father and a son, a husband and a wife. That's the one where you actually become one flesh, you know, once you christen Aristotle. So even a closer friendship between a husband and a wife is that king and subject. But you notice that waspiness, Protestant sensibilities about I'm your father, not your friend, or my wife is either my friend and we're equals, or we're not at all friends. These are just wrong. These are desacralized notions. A father and a son are friends. That doesn't mean you buy your 13-year-old alcohol to have parties. That's right. A bad version of a friend. The best friend is the one between unequals. And same thing between a husband and a wife. The best friends of all. No, we're not these postmodern men who have embraced, you know, secular humanism, and we're best friends and there's no boss in the household. That's nonsense. But we're the kind of best friends where you hardly ever have to bark orders at all because you're so close. You're one flesh with your wife. And this is how the household patriarchy works. Anyway, it's Christianity, patriarchy.
And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State. And remember, keep asking us the questions the government wants you to ignore. I'm John Kiriakou, and we'll see you next time.